Hey, it's Farnoosh, and if I had to go back to my 19-year-old self and share her my one big piece of financial wisdom that I've learned in these 25 years, it's this. You can't save your way to wealth. You can't save your way to a comfortable retirement. You have to invest your money. Luckily, I got started in my early 20s. I learned that lesson early on, and I want to share the wisdom. I want to share what I've learned over these last 20-plus years investing in the stock market. I don't pick stocks. I don't pay lots of money to work with experts, and I've amassed a seven-figure portfolio slow and steady. I'm teaching my very unsexy tricks on Monday, April 29th, live at 3 p.m. Eastern. Go to sowmoneyworkshop.com to learn more and save your spot. Go to sowmoneyworkshop.com and sign up for my investing masterclass. Even if you can't make it live, everyone who registers will get the recording.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with tap to pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone. So Money episode 242, Luke Landis.
You're listening to So Money with award-winning money guru Farnoosh Torabi. Each day, get a 30-minute dose of financial inspiration from the world's top business minds, authors, influencers, and from Farnoosh herself. Looking for ways to save on gas or double your double coupons? Sorry, you're in the wrong place. Seeking profound ways to live a richer, happier life? Welcome to So Money.
Welcome back to So Money, everyone. I'm your host, Farnoosh Torabi. Today on the show, we have whom I think is a true leader in the financial education space. He is one of the first personal finance bloggers to really take the stage in a big way in the early 2000s, before financial blogging was really a thing. And similar to J.D. Roth, who has been on the show, who was the founder of Get Rich Slowly, a very popular personal finance site, we have on the show today H. Luke Landis, or Luke. He's the founder of Consumerism Commentary. You may have heard of it. One of the first independent personal finance blogs. And on it, Luke held himself accountable for his own financial decisions. He had quite a journey to financial independence. The website became one of the most popular to provide basic financial guidance to particularly young people, focusing on education, awareness, and decision-making. And Luke also had an accompanying podcast on which he's interviewed me several times. And so I'm happy now to have him on my show and put him in the hot seat. Luke is also the founder of the Plutus Awards, a way to highlight independent financial publishers. I actually took home the Plutus Award last year for Best Personal Finance Book when I published When She Makes More. So I'm deeply grateful to Luke and to all those involved in the awards for that honor. And speaking of Plutus, Luke is also the new founder of Plutus Foundation, a community foundation with a mission to provide opportunities for the financial media community to support programs that enhance the financial capability and well-being of citizens of the world. What a mission. Several takeaways from our time with Luke. He takes us back to his not-so-money days when he was broke, jobless, moving back in with his dad. He said it was a time in his life when he was, quote, burying his head in the sand. Why? I asked him. What made him so afraid of facing the music? We talk about starting a blog and turning it into a business. You know, Consumerism Commentary was purchased a few years ago, and Luke discusses what it takes to make money as a blogger. And with the launch of the Plutus Foundation, Luke aims to spread financial awareness. What does he see today as being the greatest financial need in the marketplace? Here we go. Here is Luke Landis. Luke Landis, welcome to So Money. So nice to have you on my show this time. You've been very generous in the past having me on your blog and Consumerism Commentary. So I'm really honored to be able to pay back the favor.
Oh, no, it's not at all. I mean, I'm honored to be on your show. It's such a great show. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start by learning more about the Plutus Foundation. This is a new venture for you. Very exciting, extremely philanthropic. Share with us the mission and why you wanted to start this.
Sure. Yeah. Plutus started with an awards ceremony. And in fact, it started 6 years ago. And it was before there was a conference for our community. My thoughts behind the Plutus Awards was to create a way for the community to come together, appreciate each other, the work that we all do, and to give this idea of independent online publishing a little more of a boost and representation amongst the wider, more traditional media. Because for a while, independent publishers didn't have as much of a as much recognition as I thought this community should have. There are great writers who may not be employed by magazines and newspapers, and there's a lot of great information out there. And the Plutus Awards would be a way for us to celebrate that. We can move the community forward by paying attention to those who are doing the best work. And at the same time, it would give some of these expert independent writers an opportunity to show appreciation for the products and services in the financial industry that we feel are the best and that other companies should emulate. So that's why there's two sections to the Plutus Awards. The first is to honor independent publishers and podcasters, and the other is to show appreciation for the products and services that we think are the best.
And now you have launched Plutus Foundation. Tell us about that. That's really a broader mission, and it just recently got its 501c3 designation.
Yeah, I'm super excited about that as well. The Plutus Foundation started because I have been trying to think of how I can leave a legacy while still remaining involved with this financial community, even though the site that I founded, Consumerism Commentary, was sold several years ago. I still want to stay involved, and charitable giving and charitable missions were always a part of what I did with Consumerism Commentary. I wanted to find a way for me to continue doing this and spreading this important mission. So the mission of the Plutus Foundation is to provide opportunities for the financial media community to support programs that enhance the financial capability and well-being of citizens of the world. It's a very general mission, but that's on purpose because this will give a way for the Board of Trustees and for the steering committee to come up with what might be most needed at any particular time in terms of financial need across the world, and deal with it directly in that way. So it provides an opportunity for other independent bloggers who are doing well with their businesses and their blogs to pool their charitable resources together. And eventually create an endowment that will continue to support the things that we feel as a community are important to us forever.
What do you see as one of the greatest financial needs out there? If you had to pick one, I know this is going to be a collective decision, but according to you, what do you think is something that is in a dire need?
Well, financial literacy is an issue that's important to my heart. And I think that a lot of A lot of efforts tend to not work well. That's probably putting it a little lightly. Financial literacy efforts tend to fail, especially when you look and see some of the results over time that we get from very popular efforts and very well-meaning, such as putting financial courses as required in high school curricula. There are some problems, and there's some specific reasons why trying to teach people to stay out of debt and use good decision making when it comes to their money don't work in you know, across a variety of communities, you know, throughout the country. So financial literacy is important, but I wanted to go about it a very different way. One of the things that I think would work better than, say, putting classes in schools is to build programs directly within communities. Part of the problem with anything you learn in school is that if you go home and education isn't a priority and the lessons that you learn aren't reinforced by your home life, then the things you learn in school don't really stick with you. And by working with community leaders and with organizations, you know, I'm just throwing out a few here, like Big Brothers Big Sisters or the Boys and Girls Clubs, and work with them to develop programs within the community where the role models dealing with the financial issues are people from the communities, people respected and people that kids look up to and will hopefully see as role models that teach them how to live their life more financially responsibly. So that is why, you know, instead of looking at just doing a pure charity, you know, I turned my ideas towards a foundation, because that way we can support organizations who are already within communities doing great work, instead of coming in as outsiders and going into community and trying to leave lessons and then leave and then not provide any role model support, which is what's really necessary, I believe. So that was my initial approach to the charitable issues. You know, like we already said, that's only my personal approach, and that with a board of trustees and a steering committee, there's an opportunity for lots of voices to be heard in terms of how we're going to give support going forward.
How did you get started in this area, Luke? I know for years you ran the blog Consumerism Commentary. Your reach was outstanding. The content was very, very powerful. What made you want to enter this space? Let's go back a little bit and talk about how you got started.
It's funny that you said space, because there wasn't really a space when I started. It was, well, there was space in that there was nothing out there. What triggered Consumerism Commentary was several things. First of all, was the issues I was dealing with in my own life. I had found myself in a very precarious financial situation, and I came to a realization when I hit my personal rock bottom that I needed to figure out how to claw my way out of that hole. And I had started, this is around the turn of the millennium, I had started reading more about money management online. And one of my favorite locations to go to read great information wasn't necessarily the, you know, financial columns in the newspapers, and it wasn't the investing, you know, it wasn't the investing magazines. It was the Motley Fool, which had message boards where just about anybody could write whatever they wanted and discuss great things. There was a Living Below Your Means message board, which I think, you know, I spent a lot of time reading. At this time, I had already been a blogger. I'd been blogging since, you know, for a few years before that. And even before blogging was a word, before there was software called Blogger, I had been creating websites and updating them. So I thought, wouldn't it be a good idea if I could, you know, start a new blog? And this one would be about my own financial journey, my own journey towards improving my finances. As far as I knew, no one had done this before, and I wasn't really looking for a community. I just wanted to get my thoughts out there. There were a lot of other blogs I had tried. I had a personal blog, which was, you know, I continued updating for years until consumerism commentary kind of took over my life. But I had tried different things like a fitness blog just to track how I was doing and, you know, towards getting in shape. And it never really caught on. But the financial blog just seemed to catch something. And this was at a time, 2003, 5 years before the recession hit. So what ended up happening is that more and more people started being concerned about their own finances. More and more people started getting introduced to blogging because it became very popular after the 2004 election cycle. So over the years, this huge community grew out of financial blogging. It just didn't exist when I started. So it was really fun to be on the forefront of what ended up being this great movement. And now there's so many great independent financial writers, so many great bloggers. And, you know, they've all been inspired by their own lives and the blogs that have come before them. And it's great to have been a part of it.
Luke, let's talk a little bit about your financial philosophy as somebody who did have a lot of years under his belt writing about money and interviewing a lot of people about money. What would you say is your number one financial philosophy?
That's a good question. And I think this came much more clear to me over the years as I spent every day writing and kind of introspectively looking at myself and thinking about, you know, what's really important. And I think what it came down to is something that came right out of my own personal situation. You know, I just put my head in the sand when things started getting financially rough for me. You know, I thought that the more I ignored things, you know, life would be fine and things would just go away and I wouldn't have to deal with it. Obviously, that's not how the world works. And I kind of had to grow up a little to learn that. So for me, you know, the philosophy comes down to one main thing, which is just start paying attention. And as long as you become aware, you can look at yourself and you can self-evaluate and you can start to figure out what you need to do to move forward. I think there are other rules of thumb and other, you know, messages that people tend to like, you know, don't spend more than you're earning. I think all of those types of rules are great, but it really comes down, none of this would even be possible if you're not paying attention. If you keep your head in the sand and you're not aware of what's going on around you, nothing that anyone tells you will ever make a difference in your life. You just have to start looking at yourself and start paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Why were you putting your head in the sand? I'm curious, what was emotionally going on in your brain?
That's a good question. I was actually working for a nonprofit. This is again around the turn of the century. And I had made some bad decisions. I wasn't earning a lot of money. I was living far away from this nonprofit where this office was. And my financial situation was just getting worse and worse. And I had student loan debt to pay off and I wasn't doing it. I had credit card debt. I was taking cash advances from my credit card because I needed to pay the rent. You know, it just wasn't, the more this was getting worse, the more I just tended to ignore it. I had speeding tickets that I wasn't paying off. It turned out my license was suspended and I didn't know it because I had moved and I never changed my mailing address. I mean, there were so many decisions, which eventually led to me losing my job, losing my apartment, losing my girlfriend, and losing my car. And I'm listing those in no particular order, but you know, those are all things that happened to me within the span of about 3 or 4 months. I had to move back in with my father, who had recently just moved in with his relatively new, you know, life partner at the time. You know, my parents were divorced, about 15 years ago, and they're both happy now with new partners, but my father had just met and moved in with his new girlfriend. And so I felt myself being a burden on them. Yeah, I didn't want to stay there long. I knew I had to make some changes in my life fast. You know, it was quickly going downhill.
How old were you at the time?
I was about 23 or 24.
Mm. So this segues us to my next question, which is that along the way, perhaps you weren't given the education that you felt you needed to help you through this time early on in your life. What was your exposure to money growing up? How would you characterize it? And what's your biggest money memory?
That's a good question. I don't feel that I had an unhealthy money education growing up. I feel I just didn't put a priority on it. I was, you know, I decided to go to school to study music education, which I think is a great endeavor. I wanted to be involved in nonprofits from the very beginning. However, I was probably not in a financial situation that would make it easy to do so. And, you know, I never really kind of intellectually I knew about debt, but I never had the experience of dealing with debt. You know, my parents didn't share with me their own financial issues, but I was a pretty smart kid. At least I thought I was. I just wasn't, you know, I was probably too smart to deal with money. And that's probably part of the problem. You know, I figured things would work out if I just followed my dreams to do what I wanted. And in a way, you know, that's still good advice for a lot of people, but you have to take a practical look. I wasn't very practical, and I spent time doing things that I wanted to do regardless of what my responsibilities were, which is just kind of the way I was. And, you know, even to this day, people say I still have my head in the clouds and aren't always as grounded as I should be. You know, there's a point where that's just your personality, and you're a dreamer and you do things like that. And but at the same time, you got to be grounded, especially when it comes to something very real world like financial issues. Otherwise, you end up in trouble and nobody's going to be able to save you.
What was your moment, your money moment that you felt you turned a corner? What was that first moment like for you? Was it when you moved out of your dad's place, finally regained your job, license, car? I mean, at what point did you feel like you had turned a corner for the better?
That's a good question. I mean, the recovery for me was pretty slow and gradual, because once I lost my job and lost my apartment and went through everything that I described earlier, you know, I basically, it came down to, you need to find a job that is accessible by train and, you know, has the potential to support you financially. So I got a job for a financial company, you know, just a couple train stops away. From there, you know, I started to realize that was the first point that I started to realize that, you know, I have a potential here now to support myself and eventually support some of these dreams that I still have, like working with nonprofits and being involved in the arts. So that started me out on the path. And the corner that I turned, it was a slow turn, because different pieces fell into place over a long period of time. And probably the biggest one, you know, there were some major turning points. And the first is probably when I realized that not only could I share my thoughts online about my own personal finances and help people, but I can actually leverage that as a business. I mean, that never occurred to me when I started, but you know, these days, people don't even start a blog if they don't think that they can earn money from it. But that wasn't the case back in the early 2000s. When I realized that there was an opportunity here to build a business out of something that I love doing, writing online, that was a really important moment for me. And again, it took a long time from that point for it to be a sustainable business. I didn't quit my day job until 2010. So that's about 6 or 7 years after I started earning the first penny from the website. And so that was another turning point when I quit my day job. I probably could have done it sooner, but I wanted to, I wanted to be safe, and I saw the risk in this, and I just wanted to have a cushion for myself in case things went bad, because you never know when it comes to revenue online.
Absolutely. How did you monetize the site primarily? How were you in business with the blog?
Mostly it was advertising. And advertising, there's different forms of advertising that you can earn money from with a website. You know, it started off with AdSense. And at the time, bloggers were first starting to add AdSense onto their sites and first dabbling with monetization, because a lot of publishers were worried at the time that they would alienate their readership. And if you had a pretty big readership, that's something that you'd be concerned about. You wouldn't want to just throw up an advertisement and for someone to say, oh, look, this website has sold out to, you know, to big companies, and we don't want to read this website anymore. I found out that as long as you keep providing great articles and great content and give people a reason to keep coming back, the sensitivity is, you know, it isn't as there as much as we thought it would be. And then just over time, advertising grew. This, I mentioned the recession before. Everyone started being concerned about their personal finances, and traffic, visitors to the website, mine and many others within, you know, that within this personal finance space, just grew immensely. And advertisers were very, very interested in getting in front of a well-intentioned audience.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would say my career even just really took off during the recession. It was also the time when I got laid off. So I experienced both ends of the spectrum. I experienced, mm-hmm. you know, getting a pink slip. And then I also experienced being extremely busy and making some nice income during that time. Because like you said, everybody and their cat was interested in personal finance. So it was in some ways very opportunistic for people in the space. What would you say, Luke, is your number one money habit? Something that you practice on a consistent basis that helps you directly with your financial well-being?
Probably always checking in. And by that, I mean just making sure that my finances are doing what I expect them to do. I check my accounts almost every day, at least several times a week now. You know, one of the problems that I had with my life as the person behind Consumerism Commentary is that in order to review financial accounts and give the best information to my readers, I had to open up a lot of accounts across a wide variety of financial institutions, a lot of banks. I would review savings accounts, and I wanted to open accounts for, you know, every time I reviewed something, I wanted to have a personal experience with it. And that left me with several dozen financial accounts, savings accounts and checking accounts across, I don't know how many banks. But, you know, one of the first things that I started doing when I was moving away from Consumerism Commentary was to consolidate all of that. So between just checking my accounts regularly and consolidating and keeping things as simple as possible, those are the keys for me to, you know, staying on top of my finances and making sure I'm going in the right direction today.
And forgive me, as I don't know this, maybe I should. What happened to Consumerism Commentary? You sold it. Are you still doing it?
Yes. Well, in 2011, I sold Consumerism Commentary to a company. And this is all information that's widely out there now, so I'm not telling any secrets. It's the same company that now owns Get Rich Slowly and a few other financial blogs. They've been a great company to work with. And after I sold the website, I continued to work on it for, you know, I continued to do pretty much what I was doing, except handling the advertising side of things. I wasn't handling anything business related with the website. I was still continuing to write articles every week, several a week, continuing to promote the website and get people to come visit and interacting with other people on behalf of the website. That I did begin to pull away from it a couple of soon after the website was sold. And as of now, I'm no longer writing for the website, which is actually news for last month, about a month ago. So, you know, I'm moving forward now and focusing my time on the Plutus Foundation. You know, Consumerism Commentary is still a great site, and all the content is going to be there in perpetuity, as far as I know. So there's certainly enough for people to read through and get addicted to now. They have some other writers that will be contributing to the site going forward.
Very briefly, can you share how a blogger can go about finding someone to buy the blog? When are you in business in to that extent, and where you become attractive to a company that would want to come in and take over?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I certainly didn't start out on a path to build a business and then sell that business when I started Consumerism Commentary. So I've been kind of learning as I went along, and I don't consider myself a good business person at all. So, you know, this was all very new to me in terms of, you know, building a product or a business and then selling it. But there's always people willing to purchase a business that is producing some sort of revenue. There's always a market for it. The problem will be finding someone who is willing to pay what you think that revenue is worth. It worked out for me. You know, again, I try to look forward and look to the future. I see, in terms of business, there's a lot that still can be done with blogs, but I think that the future is going to be, you know, something more mobile, more mobile app related. I didn't see a clear transition path for Consumerism Commentary. I also saw a lot of risk in continuing. A lot of the revenue for this particular website was built on search engine traffic, and that tends to be very volatile. So there was this risk involved that a large company might feel that they're better able to handle that risk, whether it's through diversity in different websites or whether it's through the staffing necessary to make changes and to stay state of the art. I didn't feel prepared to do the things necessary to combat some of the issues that I was having with the stability of revenue. And I was lucky in that the company that was interested was willing to pay a price that took some of the risk off my shoulders. So it ended up being a good deal for me. I think it was a good deal for the company as well. Although I think some of the fears that I had in terms of what would happen if I held on to the site pretty much came true in terms of the competitiveness of search engine traffic, you know, the need to diversify in order to maintain a good business. To make a long story short, the ability to sell a business like a website depends on a lot of factors. And the biggest one is whether someone is just willing to pay you what you think is the best price. And a lot of bloggers will feel that their website is worth a lot more than, you know, a strong purchaser would be willing to pay. And that could end up in a situation where these sites just don't get sold.
So you have to be pretty reasonable and not, I mean, a lot of emotion goes into blogging, a lot of passion. So you might be clouded, your judgment might be clouded as far as the actual value. And these days, I think what's difficult is that there's so much overvaluation when it comes to blogs and any kind of financial tech service. I find that, you know, you hear valuations these days are like $500 million, $1 billion, you know, so you might think your blog is worth at least $1 million.
And part of the problem is that people read that, you know, websites do sell for 7 or 8 figures, and there's not a lot of information around that to explain why they're valued at that range. And so it makes it easy for other bloggers to think that, you know, there must be a market and I'm going to get $1 million or $2 million or $10 million. And you know, I think it just sets up some poor expectations. And, you know, the valuations in the tech industry, definitely scary. I mean, you know, I never want to call a bubble because I'm not an expert, and people who call things are generally wrong. It may not be in the public companies like it was with the dot-com bubble, but definitely in venture capital, there's just so much money flowing. And I think it clouds people's visions a little bit.
Let's do some So Money fill in the blanks, Luke, shall we?
Sure.
If I won the lottery tomorrow, let's say $100 million, the first thing I would do is
fund the foundation.
That's right. That's right. And hopefully you have some money left over to buy something fun.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, I've been renting, and you know, maybe it would be nice to settle down somewhere at some point, but I just don't know where, so we'll see.
The one thing I spend my money on that makes my life easier or better is
Blue Apron.
Yeah?
Yeah, I really like it. I'm a single guy living alone, and I don't know how much you want me to go into detail in terms of.
Well, tell us. I know what it is, but a lot of our listeners might not. So tell us what it is.
Well, it's basically an ingredient delivery service. You know, every week that you'll get a shipment of fresh ingredients and recipes, and you can cook meals for yourself. Basically, one shipment a week lasts me the entire week. And this way, I don't have to go shopping for groceries, and I don't have to put any thought into what I'm going to cook any particular week. It's just all laid out for me, and it makes my life so much easier.
And you learn how to cook, which is another bonus to this, where if you're interested in that, you know, it's another advantage instead of just ordering take-in.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm learning a lot about ingredients and, you know, what to do in order to make a meal tasty. So it's been definitely a learning experience for me, and it has made my life a lot easier.
My biggest guilty pleasure is?
Let's see. I would say coin collecting. You know, I haven't spent a lot of money on it recently, but you know, I do enjoy. I enjoy just the hobby of it. You know, just having coins to look at once in a while. Not because it's money, because you know, it's an interesting art form.
Yeah. Well, so what do you collect typically?
Lately, I've been interested in cents, and I've been interested in peace dollars. So those are probably some of my more interesting coins that I hold on to. Mostly just U.S. coins, but it's something I haven't had a chance to spend a lot of time with lately. But it's something that you know, when I do spend some time on it, I get some pleasure out of it.
Cool. One thing I wish I had known about money growing up is?
Just that money is more than just, you know, something to worry about when it goes wrong, but it's something that you need to pay attention to constantly.
When I donate, I like to give to blank because?
I like to give to arts causes. Like I said, I studied music education in college. I'm very passionate about music. I'm very passionate about theater and the arts. Those are all causes that I enjoy and get a lot of pleasure out of, you know, providing my time, treasure, and talent, as they say.
And last but not least, I'm Luke Landis. I'm so money because...
Because I really love the financial blogging community, and I'm always looking for ways to improve myself, and always looking to help other people.
Well, thanks, Luke, for all the help that you're providing us. Everybody, check out PlutusFoundation.org to learn more about how to get involved. And congratulations. It's very exciting and looking forward to seeing you hopefully at the next FinCon.
Absolutely. I'll be there, and I'll be ready to have lots of fun with everybody.
Excellent. Have a good one, Luke.
You too. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks again, Luke Landis, for joining us on So Money. If you'd like to learn more about Luke, his website, PlutusFoundation.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Luke_Landis, LANDES. All this info at SoMoneyPodcast.com, where we've got the transcript and comments from this episode and all previous episodes. And I want to hear from you. Send me your question. Click on Ask Farnoosh while you're at SoMoneyPodcast.com and send me your thoughts about money, career, family. I mean, people are asking me whether they should have kids, where they should live. The questions really run the gamut, and I'm kind of shocked you're asking me such broad questions, but I'm also pretty flattered that you would think I'd have some good feedback. So appreciate all your questions, no matter what they are. Send them over, and I will hopefully answer them on Ask Farnoosh. And if you'd like to connect with me one-on-one, just hop on to iTunes and leave a review for this show, because every Saturday I pick one new reviewer to receive that free 15-minute money blitz. So hopefully we'll connect. Thanks everyone for tuning in. See you back here next time. In the meantime, hope your day is so money. Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with Tap to Pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.